Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
We are considering it, says Joe Biden in the Rose Garden when asked about the impending decision on whether or not to continue with the proceedings against the whistleblower, truth teller, the world's greatest publisher, Julian Assange. Although having reviewed the video now myself, I'm wondering if he misheard and thought someone was asking him if he was on his way to the toilet. And as Israel murders the three sons and three grandchildren of Hamas leader Ismail Haniyeh, the Western governments appear to have recovered their confidence, shaken in the wake of the killing of seven foreign aid workers in Gaza, and have begun doubling down in support of the genocide and arming it along with it. It's all coming up over the next 2 hours on the Mother of All Talk Shows. So fasten your seatbelts. It's going to be a bumpy night.
You are listening to the Mother of All Talk Shows podcast with George Galloway.
Well, it may turn out to be a where were you at the moment that you heard that the long saga of Julian Assange's persecution by the governments of the Western world, the participants in war after war, crime after crime, were considering dropping the case against the world's greatest publisher, the world's biggest political prisoner, although he's a political prisoner invisible in the country in which he's being held. No media, none, ever concentrates on the fact that in a dungeon in London, the world's most famous journalist, most famous publisher, is incarcerated now for well over a decade. But you may come to remember today as a red letter day. The Australian Parliament and government have asked the United States and the UK to halt proceedings against Julian Assange and to set him free after well over a decade of one form of incarceration or another. The Rose Garden has been the scene of many important announcements, and this one may turn out to be the latest. Joe Biden was shuffling along, as is his wont, in the Rose Garden, in the pathway, and someone shouted from the journalistic crowd, "Have you a response to the Australian request for the dropping of the proceedings against Assange?" Without looking, Biden, still shuffling, merely said, "We're considering it." Now, on the face of it, that might be a very auspicious statement indeed. Although, as I joked earlier, he might have misheard. He might have thought he was being asked if he needed to go to the lavatory, as is his wont, oftentimes during the day. And if he can't make it, as in the case of the Pope, he just does it there and then. It may be, though, that the long calvary of Julian Assange is coming to an end. If so, the compensation will have to be mighty big. Julian Assange has been metaphorically nailed to a cross almost all of the years. In fact, all of the years, bar 1 month, that I have known him. And that is a very long time indeed. Julian Assange was falsely imprisoned, falsely accused. His extradition, first to Sweden and then to the United States, was falsely pursued. Sir Keir Starmer was one of the falsifiers. Sir Keir Starmer, the next Prime Minister, one presumes, certainly he presumes, of the United Kingdom, when director of public prosecution, egged on the Swedish prosecutors in their attempt to extradite Julian on entirely fake, bogus rape and other sexual assault charges. "This is no time to go weak," he said. "Hold your nerve. Keep it up. It was an entirely contrived set of circumstances, from accusation to the process itself." Fearing extradition to Sweden, from which he would have been promptly extradited to the United States for the real offence that he is said to have committed, namely telling the truth about war crimes in Afghanistan and Iraq, revealing to the public the kind of crimes that were routinely being committed by their own governments. That was his real crime, the crime of journalism. He was effectively accused of journalism. And that's why they wanted him in Sweden. That's why they wanted to extradite him onwards to the United States. So he took refuge in the Embassy of Ecuador in central London, just behind the Harrods flagship store in London's Knightsbridge. The long period cooped up in that tiny room, in that tiny embassy. Don't be misled by the word embassy. It was a ground floor flat in a mansion building in central London, one tiny part of which was occupied by Julian Assange, where he received many visitors from around the world, including me, my wife, and some of my children. We thought that he might be there for some considerable time, because we were unsure that the United States would ever have a government that would either drop the intention to extradite him or even pardon him. We thought that in the case of Donald Trump, he might drop the charges. He might pardon Julian, though nothing in the end came to pass on that. It's my understanding that the deep state in the United States threatened, blackmailed Donald Trump that if he were to pardon Julian Assange, he himself would pay the price. And at that point in time, Trump already had plenty on his plate. And then Joe Biden continued the Calvary. He continued the persecution. A Democratic president continued to try and extradite and send to a hanging jury in Virginia the world's greatest journalist. I said many times on this show that I could not see how that could possibly be in Joe Biden's interest. It would lose him even more of the support already dwindling amongst a certain caste of people in the United States. It would create a cause célèbre in the heart of an election year if he had to deal with a journalist in chains coming down the stairs of an aircraft from London, and then seeing that journalist put on trial, a swift and entirely unjust trial, few have any doubt. I argued for a long time that the best thing for Biden, the best thing for the Democrats, and of course, coincidentally, the best thing for the world would be for the United States to drop these charges. We'll be talking to two men who have been intimately involved in this case right from the beginning, Chris Hedges and the Honourable Craig Murray, about this story later in the show. Today, on Eid Day, having slaughtered 14 children overnight, Israel slaughtered several more in the beach camp in Gaza. Six of their victims were the children and grandchildren of the Hamas leader Ismail Haniyeh, a man I have met. These children lived in the refugee camp, as indeed did Haniyeh, before getting out of the country and heading for Qatar, where he now lives. His children stayed behind in the refugee camp, and their children with them. They were driving an ordinary car in the beach camp today when a carefully targeted strike from the Israeli occupation army took them all out in one go. In a blaze, six of the issue of Ismail Haniyeh were destroyed. I've seen the pictures of where he was visiting wounded people in Qatar, where they'd been flown for medical attention, when he got the call on speakerphone that his children and grandchildren had been murdered by the Israeli armed forces. To say he was a picture of serenity and acceptance and submission and courage would be a severe understatement. He immediately responded with the words that his children were not more valuable than the other children that had been slaughtered in Gaza. He went on to say that all of the children who had been slaughtered were his children too. He went on to thank God for his children and grandchildren being placed on the pathway to heaven, arising out of their father's struggle for the liberation of the Palestinian territory and in particular the Al-Aqsa Mosque. He thanked God for this martyrdom. He said that it would make no difference to the struggle for Palestine's liberation, and surely it will not. I'm not sure of the thought process that went into the decision to murder the family of Ismail Haniyeh, a man that Israel is right this minute negotiating with through third parties in Cairo for a ceasefire, for the release of hostages, and for a temporary, at least, end to this particular chapter of the conflict. I'm not sure if they were doing it deliberately to wreck the negotiations, to make sure that none of their own hostages were to be freed and to come home freely to speak about what happened to them, who it was that sheltered them, who it was that tried to kill them. I'm not sure if it was a deliberate act by Netanyahu himself or by elements in the armed forces who are determined to stop any kind of deal being reached in Cairo. I'm not sure that there's anybody in the Israeli leadership stupid enough to believe that killing his children and grandchildren is going to make Ismail Haniyeh give up the struggle to liberate Palestine. I'm not sure if there's anybody in Israel stupid enough to believe that this will make Hamas less popular in Gaza than they are at this point in time. Killing children and grandchildren who could easily have escaped and could easily, like the son of Netanyahu, be living in five-star luxury in a hotel somewhere way, way offshore, but chose instead to remain in their hovel in a refugee camp where they could be killed at any moment in time, either deliberately targeted or not. I'm not sure if there's any idiot in Israel who thinks Hamas is weakened by this act of mass murder of children uninvolved in any of the politics, any of the armed struggle against occupation. These were civilians. These were uninvolved family members. I'm not sure if Israel consulted its allies, including Joe Biden, as to whether this particular strike would help or hinder his re-election, which more than ever before now hinges on a scaling down of America's overseas wars, which are now so unpopular that scarcely 20% of those who would normally vote Democrat support his policy of arming and protecting Israel over these last 6 months. I'm not sure if there's anybody there who was consulted, who may not want Joe Biden to be re-elected. all of these things are up in the air, as are the missiles, the bombs, the rockets, the warplanes, the warships, the tanks on the ground, the heavy artillery just across the line now that the Israeli forces have withdrawn from the theater itself. They are raining down death and destruction on unprecedented numbers of entirely defenseless civilian men, but mainly women and children. This ghastly, obscene, horrific series of massacres will live forever. And I thought last week that we were on the verge, not least because the British government briefed the British press to the effect that Sunak was going to tell Netanyahu that Britain had concluded that Israel was committing war crimes in Gaza, and that it would therefore be impossible for the British government to continue selling weapons and participating in intelligence collaboration with a military action which they had legal advice to the effect was breaking war crime and prohibition of crimes against humanity and potentially even the ultimate crime of genocide. That's what we were led to believe the British government were going to do following the horrific murder of 7 foreign aid workers, 3 of them British military veterans, who were systematically, deliberately murdered by Israel just a week or so ago. But they've recovered their bottle. They've recovered their confidence. David Cameron said today that Britain will not be halting arms sales to Netanyahu's regime. Blinken and Austin and one American spokesman after another stated, incredibly, that they had seen no evidence that Israel was involved in the crime of genocide. Presumably meaning they have no mobile telephone, have no computer, have no television at home or in the office. Because the rest of the world has seen it in blood red technicolor for 6 months and more. So the Americans and the British are doubling down in support of this genocide. Britain's arms contribution is in quantum quite small. It's nothing like as big as the arms sales of Germany to Israel, which have increased tenfold over the last 6 months, 10 times greater than they were the previous year. The government of Nicaragua, to its eternal credit, has mounted a powerful case this week before the International Court of Justice that Germany too is complicit in the crime of genocide by not just arming but exponentially increasing the number of weapons, shells, and other military hardware that it has provided for Netanyahu to conduct these crazed, unhinged, genocidal massacres. I don't know what the ICJ verdict will be. I'm no longer even sure that it will be worth the paper that it's written on in any case. Because I'm so old, I remember that very same ICJ sending Israel for trial, plausibly, their word, accused of genocide. I'm so old, I remember the ICJ ordering Israel, ordering them to halt, cease, and desist a long list of things that they were demonstrably doing on the basis that they would compound the crime of genocide on which they were sending Israel for trial, declaring that Israel had a case to answer on South Africa's charges that they had crossed the threshold and were now involved in the ultimate crime of genocide. But Germany and Britain and the United States governments are all acting against the express wishes of the vast majority of their own people, who in ever-increasing massive majorities demand a ceasefire now, an end to the occupation now, and a Palestinian state now. The fact that governments in Western countries can so ignore the vast majority of their own people proves overwhelming that, boy, do you live in some kind of democracy. We've got some great guests tonight. It's going to be the mother of all talk shows.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive and June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive and June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
You are listening to the Mother of All Talk Shows podcast with George Galloway.
Chris Hedges, the broadcaster, writer, analyst, and host of the Chris Hedges Report. It's always a privilege, Chris, to have you on the Mother of All Talk Shows. Before we turn to the Tucker Carlson affair with the Reverend Munter, let's talk about the breaking news first. Joe Biden appears to be considering dropping the charges against your friend and mine, Julian Assange. What's your take on that?
Biden has so many difficulties now in the upcoming presidential election with eroding support. I'm certain he doesn't need or want to add the persecution of Julian Assange to it. Remember, we have had, as in Great Britain, we have had not only constant protests over the genocide in Gaza, but I think what has spooked the Democratic Party and the Biden administration is that these protests have not abated, not only in terms of frequency, but in terms of size. So they definitely don't want to add to it. So, yes, there's been talk of a plea deal, some kind of a clean out on a misdemeanor to possessing classified information. That's been in the works now for several weeks. So we have known that there has been interest on the part of the Biden administration in perhaps not extraditing Julian Assange, which is very, very good news if that happens, because, as you know, once Julian Assange is in the clutches of the U.S. prison system and the Eastern District Court of Virginia, it's a pretty bleak outlook for him ever getting out.
Well, it's a very tight timetable they're now working to because the British High Court required and answer assurances on 3 points at its last hearing, and the United States must give those very soon indeed. It can't be much more than 10 days away from now. They have to satisfy the British court on several points, but the most important one, it seemed to me, was that they would have to give an assurance that Julian would be afforded First Amendment rights in any subsequent proceedings in the United States. And it struck me immediately on reading that condition that would be a difficult one for the United States to concede. So perhaps it's in their interest now to negotiate some kind of dropping of the main charges rather than have to refuse the British High Court the assurances that they're seeking.
Well, it's interesting. I sat through the trial. I was in the courtroom, and we knew that there would be, it's almost certain that the two panel of judges would allow an appeal because under repeated questioning, the prosecutors refused to offer assurances that one, Julian would not be subject to the death penalty, and two, that he would receive First Amendment protection. Now, maybe that was done intentionally. Gordon Cromberg, the chief prosecutor in the Eastern District Court of New York, has made public statements that Julian will not receive First Amendment protection. So all they have to do is not offer those assurances, and Julian will most likely not be extradited or certainly will be allowed to appeal.
Yes, it would be better if Joe Biden is right in this consideration. He then drops the charges. Then Julian can go free. If he's merely allowed further to appeal, he continues in this incredibly unjust persecution in Belmarsh Jail.
Right. Well, my guess is that this plea deal, which has been quietly in the works, is probably the exit. It's not a matter of dropping. Well, it's a matter of dropping the most serious charges and having him plea out to a minor charge. I suspect that's the exit, if there is one.
Let me turn then. I don't know if you were able to hear us. I know you're on the move. We just were talking about the extraordinary Tucker Carlson interview, which has been seen by 12 million people in less than 24 hours, in which it seems to have come, forgive the pun, something of a revelation to many of Carlson's audience that there are Christians in Palestine, surprise, surprise, and that they are treated every bit as horrifically as the Muslims in occupied Palestine are. Has that taken you by surprise, the furor over this interview?
I mean, it's an indication of how illiterate most of the public is vis-a-vis Israel and the Palestinians. Remember, we had a church attacked and destroyed by the Israeli army in Gaza with Christians who were taking shelter in it killed. On so many issues dealing with the apartheid state of Israel and the ongoing genocide in Gaza, and I have to blame the media for this, the public has just been very, very ill-informed. And this is just one example of how the media has failed to do its job. So I wasn't surprised because of the paucity of decent coverage, with the exception of alternative media or Al Jazeera. My old employer, the New York Times, remember they ran an editorial denouncing calls for a ceasefire. I mean, and then, of course, the whole specious story about systematic sexual abuse, which turned out not to have any victims. So I think it's an example of how ill-informed the public is and how the media, the mainstream media, legacy media, has failed to do its job.
Of interest perhaps only to those of us in the same business, how do you account for Tucker Carlson's trajectory towards being the man that raises this kind of thing It's quite a surprise knowing what we do about Tucker, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, Tucker Carlson, and of course that's why he's not on Fox anymore, is actually willing to grapple with issues that challenge the mainstream narrative, this being a good example. And I think that you do it all the time. I do it all the time. But he has a kind of a megaphone or a perch because he came out of that legacy or establishment commercial media that you know, we don't have. But he's used it. I mean, he's used it in this case in a very positive way. But that's why he's no longer there.
No, I said earlier in my monologue that having been temporarily shaken by the murder of the 7 foreign aid workers, 3 of them British, 1 of them an American-Canadian, 1 Irish, I think, 1 German, having been temporarily shaken, where Western ministers, your president, were beginning to indicate that this was a red line, this was the straw that broke the camel's back, that measures would have to be taken, curbing arms sales and the rest. They seem to have recovered, these Western leaders, recovered their bottle, as we say in Glasgow, and now they're doubling down again. There's going to be no ban on arms sales from Britain. Netanyahu's not going to be told by Rishi Sunak that Britain considers Israel to be committing war crimes, both of which were briefed to the media by the British government. Austin today, Blinken today, insisting that they have seen no evidence that Israel's committing the crime of genocide. Am I right in saying they've recovered their confidence and doubling down?
Yeah, completely. I mean, it's farcical, these briefings about how Israel has not violated any international laws or the Leahy Act, any of the acts that prohibit indiscriminate use of U.S. weapons that are supplied to a foreign country. Because, of course, if they admit it once, then the pipeline has to be turned off and it has to be investigated. So they're not going to do that. I think the outrage comes from the fact that World Central Kitchen was a Trojan horse. It was set up with the embrace of Israel and the United States to replace UNRWA. It can't, of course. It doesn't have the capacity, logistical capacity to replace. This is the UN agency that supplies aid to Palestinians, hundreds of thousands of Palestinians, both within Gaza, the West Bank, and the diaspora. I mean, probably well over a couple million. I don't know the exact number. And so they had set up this entity as a way to justify the severing of funds to UNRWA and create a situation by which UNRWA would be destroyed. The global central kitchen doesn't have the capacity, doesn't have the trucks, doesn't have the drivers, doesn't have the infrastructure. Mm-hmm. In fact, Israel was going to handle the distribution. So I think the outrage was over that they were working with the Israelis essentially in this subterfuge. And then the Israelis killed all 7 aid workers in these trucks. So, I mean, one truck after the other. They were piling from one damaged vehicle to the next. And they were all gunned down by drones, probably operated by 19-year-old kids in some base outside of Tel Aviv. So I think that was where the outrage came. But it was never going to translate into a severing of arms shipments.
Now, I'm sure you've caught the news that Ismail Haniyeh, the Hamas chair of the Politburo of Hamas, 3 of his sons and 3 of his grandchildren were murdered today in what can only be a carefully targeted strike. Can't have been an accident. They were driving in a small car, making Eid family visits, and they were all murdered in a puff of smoke. And I was asking the question in my monologue, is there anyone in Washington, London, or in Tel Aviv who imagines that this crime, on top of all the other crimes, can possibly contribute to anything good? What do you say?
Well, this is the typical modus operandi of the Israeli army and has been for decades. They not only target Hamas leaders, resistance leaders, but they target their families. I knew Abdul Aziz Rantisi, pediatrician, one of the founders of Hamas. He was assassinated with his son. His wife was killed, probably in a targeted assassination at the beginning of this genocide. I knew his successor. Both he and Sheikh Yassin were both killed, and then Nizar Rayan took over. They obliterated his family house with all of his children. I've been in the house, so all of his children and his wife and everyone inside. So that's how they operate. There are no rules of engagement. If you are in any way, well, I mean, at this point, anyone in Gaza is a target. This is a war against Palestinians. But in this case, I think you're probably right. They were clearly targeted. That is the way they operate. That is the way they have always operated. It is an absolutely appalling strategy because we're talking, of course, about children. It doesn't matter who their parents or grandparents are, but that's how Israel works. I mean, when they go after a Hamas, a suspected Hamas militant in an apartment block, they'll take down the whole block. They can kill 100, 200 people up to to get one target. And that's how they that's how the IDF works. This is just normal.
Yes, but at this moment in time, we're told negotiations are at a critical stage in Cairo between the very same Hamas, albeit acting through a third party, either Qatar or Egypt or both. Is this an attempt to wreck these negotiations? In which case, does Israel really want its hostages to be returned? Are there people in Israel who don't want to see their hostages returned?
Well, first of all, I suspect a fairly large number of those hostages at this point are no longer alive, number one. Number two, if the Netanyahu government wanted the hostages returned, he could have done it on October 8th. All they had to do was create a ceasefire. Those hostages were taken in exchange for the thousands of Palestinian hostages, which include women and children, of course. There could have been a direct exchange. The Netanyahu government never wanted to do it. I think the families of the hostages in Israel have figured out that their hostages are being sacrificed. I see no good faith in these negotiations between Israel and Hamas. But you're right. I mean, this will make that intractability more intractable, but I think it was pretty intractable to begin with.
So what happens next, Chris? In your view, you're long in the tooth in this area. You know the terrain, you know the political forces at work. Is this going to continue for another 6 months, for another 6 years? At this level of intensity or what?
I think the intent is quite clear. I know the intent. I don't know the outcome. The intent is to create a humanitarian crisis of such catastrophic proportions that the Palestinians in Gaza have two choices, die or leave. They can die from smart bombs, 2,000-pound bombs, so-called dumb bombs. They can die from snipers. They can die from starvation. They can die from infectious disease. Remember, there's no clean water. Those are the options that Israel intends to lay out, and we're talking in a matter of weeks. Israel hopes that that humanitarian crisis, which of course they have engineered, let's never forget that there are thousands of aid trucks, literally just a few kilometers from Rafah. That the Israelis are not allowing into Gaza to alleviate this crisis. And they hope that that will put pressure on governments like the Sisi government in Egypt to expel or deport these Palestinians. I mean, the pier itself, remember early on, the Israeli press was reporting that there were feelers out to countries in Africa, Latin America, where in exchange for remuneration, would they take Palestinian refugees. And how would those refugees be delivered? Well, they'd walk off a pier onto a boat. So that option is also open. That's clearly the intent. I think as long as the United States, and I see no sign that they will, if they won't halt arms shipments, and I see no sign that they will, as long as those arms shipments continue, I think about 68% of munitions Israel is using now comes from the United States stockpiles, then that intent becomes, we come closer and closer to seeing that intent realized. But that is, there's no question now as to what Israel is doing and what it wants. The only question is whether the international community will continue to be as supine as it is to allow Israel to carry out this genocide.
Lastly, and I'm grateful for your time, Chris, on what I know is a busy day for you. Is Iran ever going to respond to the attack on their embassy in Damascus? Should we be looking out? Are we expecting to wake up one morning and discover some severe retaliation, which will then presumably beget a further strike from Israel and more retaliation? Are we helter-skeltering into what's always described as the wider regional war?
Well, Israel's pushing it. I think if we had to nominate a country that has practiced the most restraint at this point, it would probably be Iran or Hezbollah in Lebanon. Hezbollah does not want to see West Beirut flattened as it was in 1982 by the Israelis. There has to be some kind of a response. My guess is they'll calibrate that response in such a way as not to create a regional conflagration, which I think neither Hezbollah or Iran wants. But I think in many ways, Bibi Netanyahu may want. And so he may keep prodding Iran, poking Iran, baiting Iran in such a way that they're forced to respond with more overwhelming kinds of attacks and firepower. And then, of course, we're in really serious trouble. Then we begin to talk about the real possibility of a regional war.
Chris Hedges, as always, a pleasure to listen to your wisdom and experience. Thanks for joining us on the Mother of All Talk Shows.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
You are listening to the Mother of All Talk Shows podcast with George Galloway.
Well, I very much hope to be sitting in the next British Parliament whenever the general election comes with my next guest, not just because he's a good friend of the Mother of All Talk Shows, but because I just know he would be an incredibly effective voice for the people of Blackburn, who he seeks to represent, for the people of Britain, and for the good causes across the world. His erudition, his wit, his skill on his feet, his background as a British diplomat in the Foreign Office, as an ambassador in Uzbekistan. I think he's going to make it. And so it seems, does the Daily Telegraph, the London Times, and every other right-wing, declining, failing, fading rag across the country also seem to be worried about it, because they're writing about him almost as much as they're writing about me. He is the Honourable Craig Murray. Welcome back to the show, Craig. I'll see you on Saturday in Blackburn at the conference we're both addressing. But let's, before we get on to British political matters, talk about Julian Assange, your friend and mine. How seriously are you taking the mumbled words of the doltish US president in the Rose Garden this afternoon?
I'm sorry, George, you've actually got me at a disadvantage. I've been actually on a boat all afternoon, which I got off a few moments ago, so I've not seen it.
Well, it's a most splendid way to avoid watching Joe Biden. I wish I'd been on a boat this afternoon. But here's what happened. The Australian government, Parliament, asked the US and UK authorities to cease the proceedings against Julian and to set him free. So Joe Biden was walking along the Rose Garden path when one of the journalists in the press corps shouted, "What's your response to the Australian appeal to drop the charges against Julian Assange?" And Joe Biden answered, without looking to the journalist, he answered clearly, volubly enough, but whether or not he was thinking straight remains to be seen. But he answered, "We are considering it." So the British news is leading with US considering dropping the charges against Julian Assange. Now, that may turn out to be a false dawn. On the other hand, it may be one of those days where you have to remember that you are on a boat quite oblivious to the news that our friend was about to be freed.
Yeah, that would be amazing. It's interesting because Biden has always before stuck to the line that it's up to the Justice Department, it's nothing to do with him, it's nothing to do with the White House. And he seems to have that line quite off pat. That seems to have been his remembered response to anything to do with Julian Assange. So that is a very significant change. I know we all know that Biden's no longer fully on top of his mental faculties, so you can't always take anything spontaneous from him as being any more than fumbling for a response. But I think that's so different from what's come out of him before that it must have meaning. And it really is very interesting. I've never had any doubt that the Americans don't want him back before the presidential election, because it's going to be another big headache for Biden to have the entire media angry over freedom of speech issues if Julian Assange arrives in the United States in chains. So delay, as we've continued to see, delay in the process at the High Court and Julian remaining in Belmarsh is what I've been expecting to see. And it may be, again, this is simple appeasement while that continues to happen. We will have to wait and see.
I spoke earlier in the show with our colleague Chris Hedges, who speculated that not only that the Americans definitely don't want him back in an election year, they don't want this the optics of a journalist in handcuffs, in chains, coming down aircraft steps. They've got so many problems already, do the Democrats. But that it may be that these assurances that the High Court asked the US for were deliberately asked on the basis that the US cannot and will not accept them, will not give those assurances. If that were to come to pass, Julian gets leave to appeal, presumably remaining in the bowels of Belmarsh. If Biden, after consideration of the Australian appeal, effectively drops the charges, or drops the most serious of those charges at least, well, we might be partying with Julian as soon as he's fit enough to do so, and much sooner than we expected.
Well, that would be fantastic. I mean, it's been 12 years of struggle campaigning for Julian, campaigning to get him out, first from what was in effect imprisonment in the embassy, and then from Belmarsh jail these last 5 years. As you know, I'm very close to Stella and the family, and seeing the toll, the human toll it has had on them and on Gabriel, his brother, and John, his father, you know, has really been very, very tough emotionally. So the notion of him being reunited with his family would be simply amazing. But I'm not going to get too hopeful immediately on a few words out of the mouth of Biden, because there just has been no previous indication. And there's been nothing from the Justice Department so far to indicate any easing up from the American side. So this is entirely new, if true, but we have to be a bit cautious and wait to see what comes.
Now, talking a few words, you've been allowed very few words from some of the media that are growing increasingly interested in your parliamentary bid to come and sit beside me in the House of Commons. When we're over the target, we experience the flak, of course. But were you surprised at the interest of the national broadsheet media in your imminent candidature in Blackburn?
It's extraordinary. I'm very happy to say that I think the vast majority of the good people of Blackburn have got far too much sense to pay to read the Times or the Telegraph anyway. So I don't think it's actually going to reach any of them. But in fact, I was quite flattered by the Times article. The Times article quoted a number of things that I had said, which obviously they expected their readers to be horrified by. But they are things I'm quite proud and happy I said, and which I stand by today. You know, I said that what happened on the 7th of October was a reaction to 75 years of vicious oppression of the Palestinians by the Israeli state. And I said that for a single day, the boot had been on the other foot. Now, those statements are simply true. I stand by them. I don't condone random violence against civilians by anyone, but all occupied nations in the all occupied peoples in the history of their armed resistance against their occupiers always end up, you know, in acts of armed resistance. And that's what we saw on the 7th of October. And the idea that the, you know, the Times thinks it was horrified people, that I state such a plain truth, I think is quite amusing.
Well, the good news is that Rupert Murdoch is turning in record losses. I don't know if you caught up with the News Corp latest figures. The Sun has lost £54 million in one single year. And their talk TV outfit, having come off the air and gone on to the internet, is now sacking some of their biggest names and biggest paychecks. The one and only Vanessa Feltz was fired today after her show because they can no longer afford her £800,000 a year salary for a show routinely attracting between 10 and 12,000 viewers. So the Times might not be with us for very much longer, at least not under its present ownership. But doesn't what you just said there illustrate the extent to which these journalists and the politicians, symbiotically living off each other, are living in a very small bubble? And what they imagine will have the public clutching their pearls about is actually, quite often, already the prevailing orthodoxy and the perceived truth and wisdom amongst the great majority of the population.
I think that's definitely true. And I think Gaza has underlined the terrible genocide in Gaza, has underlined the distinction between the political and media class and the general population, the fact that the political and media class no longer represent anybody. You know, they have their own very strange set of views, of which ardent Zionism as a kind of membership ticket for entry to the political class is one of them. which are simply not shared by the general population, and the political and media class together are dependent on the billionaires in whose pocket the vast majority of them are. And they reflect the views of those billionaires. They don't reflect the views of the general public in any way, and they don't represent the views of the general public in any way, which is why we're seeing this vast wealth gap growing, where, you know, we are going. The Financial Times was saying that within the next 5 years, the world will have its first trillionaires. And at the same time, even in a highly developed economy like the UK, we have children who cannot eat properly. That can only happen in a system where there is no connection between the people and the political class, and the ordinary people have no ability to affect what's happening. That's why we have to smash this two-party system where the only choice people believe they have at elections is between two conservative parties.
Now, let me an unexpected ball at you. As you know, I've given up Scottish politics, so I don't raise this for any partisan reason. I have no intention of being involved in Scottish politics again. But the first week of the SNP Green government's Hate Act, the new hate law, has gotten off to a simply disastrous start, it seems to me. The people are reporting each other in hundreds, if not thousands, of cases, and the police are simply overwhelmed. The police have more or less said they cannot enforce this law. What's your take on that?
It's a crazy law. It always was. It's extremely illiberal. It specifically states it includes performance, for example. So it includes plays and films and comedy. It includes the act of communicating hate speech from one person to another person, which could include, for example, if you were to give somebody a piece of music which contains words that would be defined as hate speech, which would probably include a great many rap songs, for example, would probably fall foul of this law. The act of giving the music as a Christmas present or whatever would be a crime. And then you have a fact that under Scottish law, anything that can be seen on the internet and read on the internet in Scotland, if read on the internet in Scotland, is deemed to be published in Scotland. So it covers all communications worldwide which are seen in Scotland. So it's no surprise that the police had 8,000 reports in one week. It's a dreadful piece of legislation, which is totally illiberal, and really does, I'm afraid to say, reflect this dreadful sort of nanny state attitude on the part of the government in Scotland.
Well, I'm actually in Scotland right now. I'm speaking to you in foreign parts on a quayside. I've got my wood-burning stove on, and I'm speaking freely to you, whether the SNP government likes it or not. So let's hope I don't get the knock on the door. Craig, I'll see you on Saturday, God willing. Go safely. I know you had a little accident. Tell us, how's your shoulder, your arm?
Progressing less well than I would like. I'm seeing the surgeon again on Friday, but it looks like it's going to be another week or two. But there's a huge amount of soft tissue damage. I've got the bones together again, but it's all taking some time to heal.
Well, we wish you all the best. Hope to see you at the weekend. Craig Murray, Honourable Craig Murray, former British ambassador, prospective parliamentary candidate for the Workers' Party of Britain in the great parliamentary constituency of Blackburn. Thanks for joining us.
You are listening to the Mother of All Talk Shows podcast with George Galloway.
Let me take two quick calls, one from Sarkar, a legend in Glasgow, and the last from Norma, the legend in Bristol. Sarkar first. Go ahead, sir.
Thank you so much, George. keep going with the show, even if you retire from politics. That's my humble request. George, it's a very serious question. See, I don't know why the British media have not been very vocal about this. A few days ago, the Kosovan Prime Minister, I personally believe Kosovo is a very important part of Serbia, no matter how much the West try and separate that through their means, machinations. It's almost 30 years for the bombing of Yugoslavia. We know what happened, that illegitimate bombing by NATO. The Kosovo Prime Minister a few days ago said we need more British troops to save us from a Serbian invasion. I emphasize on the word more. Does that mean our British troops are already there over there? I don't know, George, what's this obsession with trying to always decimate Serbia? Have they not had enough of bloodlust after decimating Yugoslavia? I'd like to hear your views, George.
They hate Serbia. I once read a poem. I cut it out and put it on my wall when I was very young. I just remember one couplet from it. Some men hate a crab because it runs sideways, not straight. They chase it madly along the beach with a stick. And I always think of Serbia when I think of that couplet. They hate Serbia for reasons which they are actually incapable of enunciating, because it is entirely irrational, illogical, to hate Serbia in the way that they do. But if you're looking for a reason, they hate Serbia because it runs sideways, not straight. It's its own man. It's its own woman. The Serbian people are their own people. They believe in themselves. They believe in their religion. They're proud of their culture. They're proud of their society. And they don't take orders from these Western regimes that are desperate to push them into hatred of Russia. Serbia will never hate Russia. They'll always love Russia, because Russia always stood by them, even in their darkest hour that you just described 30 years ago. Last call is from the legend that is Norma in Bristol. Go ahead, Norma.
Hello, George. A bit of a lighter note. I noticed you put this lovely picture of Paul Robeson on the earlier today, and he was a terrific hero of mine. He was born on April the 9th, so it's topical on 1898, I think. But he should never be forgotten, George. I mean, his skills were huge. His voice was just marvellous. And he was in Shakespeare, he was in Othello in London, but of course he couldn't go back to his hotel through the front door. He had to go through the back door because he was black. But you see, the thing I wanted to say was, because I actually saw him in concert in Bristol, and I visited in Harlem where he had a little house on Sugar Hill a long time ago when I went to America. And it was amazing. But his voice, and Joe Hill, when I hear that, it just stirs me to tears. So I want to, he was in your Hall of Fame, I know, but never to be forgotten, George.
He was
never.
The first, I think he was the first person in our Hall of Fame, if I'm not mistaken. A beautiful call from you. I'm glad you're back on the show, Norma, and a very beautiful and typically generous call for you to make. Paul Robeson was born more or less on this day, probably yesterday, in 1898. And for those who don't know him, which is a surprisingly large number of people, you really should study more about him. He was the voice of God before Pavarotti. He had a voice like no other. He was taller than almost anyone on the planet. He was such an athlete that he became the first black American football player at a national level. He was an actor of Shakespearean brilliance. He was a film star. He was bigger than the Beatles in his day. And he lost it all Because he stood up for peace and against war. Because he refused to kowtow to the prevailing power in the United States. He loved the Soviet Union. He loved China. He loved Africa. He spoke more languages than you'd think it was possible for anyone to be able to speak. He could speak, write, and read in 30, 40, 50 languages fluently, could sing in those languages. This was a rare genius, a pure diamond. A diamond individual was Paul Robeson. And he ended his life in isolation and penury. They took his passport away. They wouldn't allow him to perform in public. They wouldn't allow him to speak in public. He was no platformed. He was shunned and sidelined. But he will forever, for you and me, Norma, be one of the greatest heroes of our time. Thank you for making that call. And thank you for watching this show, which sadly now must come to an end. I wish every faithful Muslim watching this show, hearing this message, Eid Mubarak, happy Eid. May God accept your fast. But I beg you, Muslim and non-Muslim, not to forget that the Palestinian people, particularly in Gaza, but elsewhere too, are this evening in their tents, having bombs, rockets and shells tear them and their children apart. They're not fasting today. They're just starving. If you think that we can sleep peacefully without thinking of them, I think you're making a mistake. It's the mother of all talk shows.